as a refresher for your advisors that, you know, trying to figure out how do I navigate X, Y, and Z. What we have done, at least with the rep page, when you log in, we certainly have updated the WSP, the form CRS, the disclosure form. And for the advisors that participated on the call 3 months ago and 2 months ago, I believe back in late March, you know, the issue here with Reg BI is really trying to level the playing field with the investment advisory committee and that community. So if you think about it just in terms of what is our end game and what are we trying to accomplish as brokers, it's really to level the playing field. So what does that mean for you and your customers? What do I need to do? It basically starts with, you know, providing additional disclosures to customers with regard to your role as an advisor. And, you know, certainly for some of you that are duly registered, you're familiar with these types of disclosures through Part 2B supplements and ADVs. But with the broker-dealer community, this is certainly an arena where the SEC, as well as many other regulatory bodies, felt that, you know, customers need to be fully informed and, you know, should also be aware of kind of what they're looking at from a service perspective and what that service costs. And, you know, that's really the spirit of Reg BI. the name and the title, I think, speaks for itself. And as I mentioned to you before, I believe that each one of you and your reps are acting in the best interest of your client. That being said, now what the rules are requesting you to do is document that review. And how well do we do that? And what do we do there? So, you know, in terms of the form CRS and the broker summary disclosure form or the broker dealer summary, really paints that picture in terms of here are the features, here's how we operate as a firm, as an advisor. Gives them the opportunity to ask questions. It certainly gives that customer what we consider the opening conversation type of questions. Most importantly, right, how do you get paid? What are the services? What do you provide for my fee, number one, or how do you determine commissions, et cetera? So, you know, that being said, as an advisor, I think what this does, more importantly than anything else, it forces you as reps to document your rationale. And I've said this before to the other soups during the calls, you know, when I deal with an advisor, it's usually in a case where there is a complaint, a litigation, and going back to the advisor, it's tell me about the relationship with your client. Why did you recommend X, Y, and Z, either strategy and or individual security? And then it's going back to the rep, ensuring that they have taken their copious notes, that they can articulate the rationale and why they did something. But not every rep does that. Not every rep has either a 3x5 card or a memo to the file. What this does is it forces that advisor to really document why they're doing something. So if you think about it from a perspective of a supervisor, it's answering that question for you. And you know, the biggest challenge, I think, for a new rep now is, what do I do going forward? I have a brand new customer. What do I do? How do I proceed? And when you're looking at the procedures in terms of a practical sense, it's, well, yes, we have the form CRS. We have the disclosure summary. That goes to the customer, so they can make an informed decision on if this is something that they want to either continue with or, you know, change gears. From a new customer relationship, I see it being very, very simple and straightforward in that the disclosure documents are supplied to the customer. The customer does decide to open up a new account. The WIS agreement is completed. They attest to the fact that they receive these disclosure documents. If it's product specific, meaning a package product of sorts, where there's an additional disclosure for a REIT, an annuity, we have built in the rationale for for why a rep is making that recommendation for the customer within the form. So if you're thinking about it in terms of, well, I think just an annuity is going to be the right call, there's a rationale for why you're recommending that annuity and what the features are surrounding it. If you're recommending just an equity individual brokerage account, well, that there are the challenges that I think the reps and the supervisors are going to have to face. It's based on what? And what I mean by that is we have a transaction cover sheet. And that's really there and designed to capture those types of transactions where we don't know where to put you in the box, right? It's not a mutual fund or an annuity or a REIT, structured product, a seat, whatever it may be. And that transaction cover sheet, when you look at it, it forces the rep to make the rationale on why they're making this recommendation. So you're an advisor. You determine based on the parameters that you and the client have selected that they are a growth and income model. That's their objective and their risk tolerance is moderate. And maybe you decide to put together a basket of ETFs. You'll have to rationalize those specific strategies when you open up the new account. So the question comes down to, well, great, it's going to be a growth and income. I've determined that it's going to be 60% in growth and 40% income. And here's what we're looking at. That goes into the transaction cover sheet. That way a rep can document to the supervisor, here's what we're doing based on the investment objectives and risk tolerance. Now, fast forward 6 months later, maybe that rep to change a security from the existing position. We're not looking for a new transaction form. However, if the investment strategy changes, we are absolutely looking for a transaction cover sheet. And what I mean by that, if you're buying a portfolio of 60% equities and 40% fixed income, and you're buying those equities based on the growth component, you're buying the fixed income based on the income component, what types of securities are suitable based on the risk tolerance? Conservative, moderate, aggressive. If that specific strategy deviates or changes within the customer dynamic, then I would suspect and expect that a new updated transaction cover sheet will be included. If they're changing the strategy, so if all of a sudden now it's 100% growth, there should be memorialization of on why we're making that change. Now, the other challenge here to a rep that has an existing account on the books, your existing accounts have been receiving and will receive the appropriate disclosures electronically and or through the mail. That's already been done for you. But fast forward, whether you open up a new account next week or you have an existing customer, if you do a variable annuity transaction a year from now, the customer gets an updated form for the disclosure, and they also have to complete, obviously, the variable annuity disclosure form. So that's one of the unique features to some of these, or if for some reason, you know, down the road, a customer also opens up an alternative product, at which point they would receive, again, a relationship summary disclosure form. So if you think about it in terms of, I mean, I think the easiest way to think about this is for those of you that have purchased a home or refinanced, it's a stack of paperwork. We're going to inundate those customers, unfortunately, with a stack of paperwork. Whether they read it, I hope they read it all, because they're attesting to you and to me as a firm that they've read those disclosure documents. You know, and some of the other challenges that that we will see in terms of interest, and one of the hot buttons here, and this is nothing new to Western or to you, you know, it's the rollover from the retirement account. You know, that's another hot button in terms of making sure that these issues have been disclosed. We've updated those forms. They're certainly on the website, but you have the ERISA rollover form. That's a big hot button for the regulators at this point, making sure that the customer understands what he or she is investing in, and what they are giving up. So again, we try to insulate the advisor, the firm, and the customer in terms of fair transparency. And that's really the point to these exercises is there should be nothing a customer will tell us they cannot claim they were not aware. Excuse me one second. That they are not aware of the features of my product. So on the public site, we're updating that tonight. So when the customers log in, if they just go to WIS Direct, they will see a regulation best interest. They'll see our disclosure forms. They will see the form CRS disclosure forms. We've also included for them additional resources. And what I consider really the summary of best interest. And just to let you know what that looks like, it's basically a 70-page document that certainly expands upon the form CRS and broker summary. But it goes into fine detail in terms of the types of securities that are available in the marketplace, general descriptions of what an equity is or what an annuity is. You know, so if you think about it in terms of full and fair disclosure, the customers have that at their fingertips. In addition to what we have done for your customer is put out, you know, additional spreadsheets where every investor alert through FINRA with regard to trading, margin, scams, you know, phishing, whatever investor alert was published, it is on that website. In addition to that, we've also provided work tools and calculators that FINRA have put out. So what those links do, they directly force that customer, if they click that link, directly goes and forwards to the FINRA website. So it's what we're trying to do to accomplish, you know, full and fair disclosure with the customers. And, you know, initially when you open up an account, that packet in terms of, you know, what is really included in the new account packet, it's going to be quite voluminous. And, you know, one of the features that we have looked at on the new account form, we have added, you know, for those that want to receive information delivered electronically, we have them check that off because that also includes disclosures that if we need to make updates to anything, we can send it to them electronically without mailing them a stack of paper. You know, in today's environment with trying to be greener, but also trying to maintain some efficiency, electronic delivery, as long as they attest to that and agree to that, we will deliver. With regard to the reps resource tab, so when the reps log in, there is a Reg BI tab right in the middle. They can click that. That would take them directly to the regulation best interest page. And you'll see FAQs from FINRA, C, SIFMA, WIS. You also see the written supervisory procedures. You will also see the two forms. So it's certainly an area where reps can really become familiar with all the FAQs that are out there from the SEC and from FINRA. But I think it puts, and certainly the ones that have taken the test, all of you have taken the exam through Quest. You know, I took it as well. I think it's fairly informative, you know, but from a practical standpoint is, again, I think it's what does all this mean for me? But there are certain transactions where the rep will have to disclose the products and features and will have to attest that they've delivered it, the form CRS. And so we do have a rep acknowledgement form. So if a customer down the road decides to do something different, where maybe it doesn't require an update to a new account form, but it would require a form CRS, the reps can deliver that, and the reps would just sign the CRS acknowledgement form that they have in fact delivered the document. But we're also putting the burden back on the customer. The customer needs to be fully informed, and they are aware of the features of their accounts. So it's something to think about from a real granular level if you were as a rep. And I'll give you an example that I may ask, or your supervisor may ask, if a rep opens up an individual account. They may ask, well, why an individual account as opposed to any other account? Well, they already have an IRA. Great. What about a TOD? Do they have a trust? No, we're going to be doing the IRA, or we're going to be doing the individual. So when you're looking at that in terms of establishing an account, it's, again, why are we doing it? And having to articulate that. But if you open up a TOD, you're probably going to state the rationale for the TOD is circumvent, you know, an estate issue. Or if we're opening up an IRA, what are we doing and why are we doing it? But I think it's only going to help supervisors and reps, because you're not going to be able to go back in time and say, what do we have on this particular client from 2 years ago? But at least what we have on the surface, we have that disclosure document and we have the rationale on why a rep decided to do something. I'll just answer a couple of quick questions here. I do see, you don't see my face, that's strange. I'll see if that works. As far as the documents, they're on the website. Transaction cover sheet needed on discretionary when an IMA is on file? No. So if you think about it in terms of broker versus RIA, you know, the investment management agreement details out specifically the relationship and the capacity in which the rep is acting. But I certainly think it's a good use, because it really forces that advisor, and I can't say that term, I have to say that term loosely. I put out a memo with regard to reps, and I think we posted on the blog today. If you are a rep only, you cannot use the term financial advisor. You know, so we blogged about some additional other types of titles, whether it's, you know, financial consultant, but the words financial advisor are excluded from that definition as a broker only. And most of the advisors that are out there that are only doing brokerage business, I haven't seen too many of them, but we've certainly reminded them on their signature lines, if they have a website, but most of it's on their emails, business cards. If they do have financial advisor and they're a broker, they will need to change that. So we're going through what we can in terms of just trying to do a check and balance, but certainly supervisors at the forefront that if you're corresponding with advisors via email, they will have to change their email signature. If they do not have an understanding of how to do that, they can certainly reach out to IT or really anyone else. I think in compliance, you should be able to help them, but it's a simple update. But I think the issue in terms of, again, U.S. supervisors is really getting a handle on why the rep is doing something. And all they're doing, honestly, all they're doing is documenting what I think they've been doing from the get-go. The folders or your client files will be, I think, that much larger. But certainly for every transaction that you do with regard to a REIT, a VA, there's going to be another disclosure form. But I don't think it's any more different than what you were doing before. And a couple of questions here. What point should the rep submit a TCS for existing clients? Good question. And my recommendation would be to do it sooner than later. And what I mean by that, if the strategy or investment objectives change with regard to the existing client, absolutely. But what's the benchmark? What's the starting point? You know, I think that's the challenge at this point, is trying to figure out, okay, why, you know, Mr. Smith, why did you make the recommendation for Mrs. Jones to do this? And that may be just an additional follow-up with that advisor. But if they're doing package products, the annuities, the REITs, direct business, they're going to fill out a form anyway, and you'll have that rationale. But if you see a sudden shift in activity, if you're looking at the trade blotters and you see a shift in activity, what you may want to end up doing is taking a look and say, why are we making this change? And then request a cover sheet. That way you can articulate it back to the rep in terms of explain to me what we're doing. And that just goes in the rep file or the client file. Question, what is required if hourly financial planning is provided and a WS agreement is signed? Right. So you're operating underneath the guise of the Investment Advisors Act. You're filing a financial plan. There's a financial agreement that's dictated in terms of the services. There's no additional needed paperwork for that. You know, certainly if you implement a brokerage account based on a financial plan, then that will trigger, if this is a brand new customer and the only services you've been providing were a financial plan where you charge the fee, they receive the financial planning agreement along with the ADV. But at that point, it's determined that the best approach for the customer will be a brokerage account. Then we go through the same exercise. New brokerage account, and here's what's required. I'm just going through some of my additional notes. Bear me with me 1 second. I think that was the last chat. So as supervisors, we won't necessarily be asking for copies of the transaction cover sheets. So if a rep is changing, but we are going to be expecting that they are completed and provided. And that'll be on the broker side or the rep side and the soup side. But as I mentioned, I think this ultimately services the reps, the supervisors, and certainly the customers in terms of having those types of conversations. With regard to the advisory account, correct. The advisory accounts, if you're opening up an advisory account, your standard form ADV Part 2B supplements, the form CRS still goes. But as far as discretionary trading, that all falls underneath the Advisors Act. However, if you are in fact making an investment in a brokerage transaction outside of that, then the form CRS would take shape. And I do see a question here. No, you do not need a form transaction cover sheet for every stock trade that you buy. No. As I mentioned, if you're switching because of Intel versus AMD or AT&T and Verizon, no. If you're changing the philosophy, then a transaction cover sheet's required. The idea here isn't if you're trading, 20 times a year on why did you recommend IBM over Intel? If the philosophy is, yes, we're going for a growth-oriented component, but I'm not asking for a rep to have 100 pieces of paper if they have do 100 trades in a year. So a question that has come up also, product specific disclosure form or a transaction cover sheet? Simplest answer is a transaction cover sheet is when there's no other disclosure form available. The specific disclosure forms do have the format with regard to the rationale why you're doing something. With regard to the titles of advisor, yes, if you are a investment advisor IAR representative, then you can, the financial advisor term is permissible. It's for the broker only. And we have put out, if I'm not mistaken, at least on the blog, there's a list of kind of approved titles and what reps should be using. So you should be able to see that on the website. Question with regard to existing brokerage accounts that do not have a transaction cover sheet. Should one be created with the first trade? I think it is a best practice. Correct. To establish a base, I think it'd be a best practice to do that. And well, why are we doing this? Well, here's what's taking place. But the existing accounts, if there is a change in the investment objective or a new product that does not or that requires its own disclosure form, the transaction sheet will not be required on those documents. Question on transaction cover sheet required for advisory accounts established as non-discretionary. The non-discretionary still operates underneath the Advisors Act if it's an advisory account. So the answer is no. If we have, I'm not sure how many we have. I think it's a limited number of non-discretionary types of accounts on advisory. But the difference is, does it fall underneath the 40 Act or not? Can we use both, or can, if we do both, brokerage accounts and also a sub-advisor, can our card say financial advisor? Again, if you're an associated person that is acting as a registered, an IAR, investment advisor rep, then that term would apply. So what we did as a firm is we went back through and looked at those reps that are associated with us, quote, as a advisor representative, and only those reps that were what we consider the AG code. There were approximately 165 reps that were only AG. So those reps would be looking to either, if they hold themselves out as a financial advisor, to change that title. And I have tried to stress with advisors that I've spoken with one-on-one to at least familiarize themselves with the frequently asked questions from the SEC, from FINRA, from SIFMA. But as we all know, it's easier said than done sometimes, but it does take some time. But those FAQs and some of the other resources are very, very helpful for advisors to understand in what context that they will be operating. So I think if they do have questions, I'm available. The Q&As are out there. I think the best Q&A that they can look at is probably the one from the SEC. But it's going to require the reps to do some of their own work. But from an advisory standpoint, you know, I think that, and a supervisory standpoint, I think that, you know, as long as the reps and the supervisor are on the same page in terms of why we're doing something, so yes, with CRS, we'll go to advisory clients as well as retail. So we uploaded our form CRS to the SEC website since we're a dual registrant. And that's basically a two-page front and back along with the disclosure form. But the idea here is to inundate what we can with as much information as we can about the relationships that the rep have with the customers, fees associated with the customers, and all applicable sales charges, et cetera. But it's also just providing some additional guidance, education to each customer. So when a customer logs into Western and they can drop down and see this, you know, 67-page document, that they need to understand what an equity is or a bond or a mutual fund annuity, they have that information and to provide them some additional resources. I think it just levels the playing field for the advisor and the customer, because the challenge we have as reps and supervisors is and you've heard me say this before, the customers need to understand what they are buying. And I hear this all the time where as much as they sign documents, they still will attest to the fact that they didn't understand them. So what we're trying to do is provide as enough information that's readily available on any specific product or service, along with resources, tools, web links. There shouldn't be any topic out there that a customer cannot get from visiting the website and learning about a specific product or service. And that's really what the end game here is. I'm just scrolling through if there's any questions that I did not see. Corey's sending me something here. All right, so a question has been asked, two questions actually. The WS FAQs notes a transaction delivery form. I don't see that on the forms available. I will check with IT, but that's basically the rep acknowledgement form that the rep will complete if they're delivering it outside the normal scope. Regard to direct, are there important differences in this process for directly held funds? Answer is no. Customer will still receive the appropriate disclosure forms. And within those disclosure, they do talk about in terms of the use of a prospectus and what the rationale is. But certainly on a directly held product, form CRS disclosures, et cetera, still apply. And I certainly understand, I mean, some of the challenges. You know, I think that with the product specific disclosures, I think that's going to be a straightforward, you're going to receive a copy of it. It's going to have the rationale why this recommendation is being made. All the disclosures are listed on that form. I think just the uniqueness to this whole procedure is just a brokerage account where maybe you buy some ETFs. But at the same point, you know, it may come to a head where you're looking at transactions on a 60-40 split in a brokerage account. You know, if the transactions seem to increase in frequency, you know, maybe that decision at that point you know, the analysis is made and determine that perhaps an advisory account is best suited. That if they're trading more, much more frequently, maybe it's a different commission structure, or maybe it's an advisory account that may be more advantageous. You know, but again, those are facts and circumstances. So if you're looking at an account that consistently either, you know, buys and sells and trades, well, maybe depending on what the investment objectives are, the advisory account may be more advantageous. You know, so what does this mean for a rep that has, you know, account that frequently trades? The determination will have to be made in terms of, well, we think this may be suited for an advisory account because the cost to the client is X, where in fact, for the same types of services, we could diminish and minimize those costs. So that's an analysis that will be done certainly by, you know, hopefully the rep, the supervisor, compliance personnel, SUPs, on why they're looking at that. And how is this in the best interest of the client? But I don't think that that's an issue that can be ignored. You know, it's certainly an issue that has to be tackled and grappled with in terms of, you know, what's the trading strategy and why are we doing it and how is this in the best interest? But we certainly tried to cover as many different, you know, scenarios as possible. But, you know, that retail customer, and remind you, this applies to retail, what I would consider like your 95% of your book of business is retail people, helping them either draft a plan, trade for them. But the idea here is if you see an increase in transactions, you know, maybe there's a different alternative. You know, as much as this rule becomes effective, I still think that there's going to be a learning curve. Without a doubt, because there are going to be some situations and questions that come up and we will have to tackle them and have to deal with those, you know, but I believe at the surface on coming out of the gate, you know, in terms of new account paperwork, the rationale, I think we're a step ahead. I believe there is a tab on your phone. I think if it's or on your computer, *6. If you have a question that I did not see that you typed in chat, you should be able to ask a question.
Hello, Brad.
And certainly just be aware that there are, as I see, three sheets of people. But I'll try to get to everyone's question. And if it becomes a logistical nightmare, we'll have to do a different way. Did someone just ask something?
Yeah. I'm only on the phone, Brad. It's Ron Freund here.
Yes.
Hi. So I had sent you a memo earlier. I was reading this article talking about the duty of care provision. And this article says it requires all reasonably available product alternatives to be considered. Now, that seems overwhelming. What's your interpretation of how to deal with that?
Well, right,
does that
but
make
I think
sense?
It's yes, and makes sense in a fashion to where what would be deemed reasonable. So, cost is certainly an option. It does not necessarily mean that's the only option. You know, but if you're looking at one mutual fund versus another, or one annuity versus another, you know, have you considered all relevant factors? Why, again, that goes to the rationale on
right.
Why I recommended this particular annuity. Why the Nationwide annuity? Why the Jackson annuity? Either for lower expenses, but it doesn't mean you gravitate mm-hmm. toward the cheapest one, because the cheapest one may not be the best one. The cheapest one may not offer other features that certain products and services or products offer.
So you wouldn't have to compare a mutual fund to an annuity, to a brokerage. I mean, you wouldn't have to compare a whole range of alternatives.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Correct.
You would not. Okay.
Yeah, you would not have to do that. Okay. Again, you're making the recommendation. You're making a recommendation for an annuity. There's a specific reason why the annuity makes sense.
Okay, so to like, orange to orange, so to speak, apples to apples.
Yes, I think that's an excellent way to approach it.
Oh, good. You know, just a quick suggestion at some point, you may want to put together, I think I mentioned this once before, a little checklist for the reps so that there's some standardization or uniformity in how we document the rationale. It's a suggestion, since it's an open-ended question right now on the form.
Understood.
Okay.
Brad?
Yes.
Along that same line, all of the mutual funds, or most of them, have different classes. So A shares, could you justify charging someone A share at 5.5% when the family mutual fund has an institutional class, I shares?
Sure. I mean, again, it's case specific because not every investor qualifies for the institutional. If you look at any prospectus for a mutual fund, there will be a classification for the institutional share class. The barriers to entry could be $100,000 minimum, could be $1 million. Every fund operates differently. So if you selected the Growth Fund of America because of expenses, because of longevity with the asset manager, the company, and I feel this is in the best interest of my client. A share, C share, any other share class. Right, the rationale would be, why did I select the A? We do have a mutual fund analyzer. But the reason why I'm looking at the A share is, oh, this particular customer is planning on holding this longer than 5.5 years. It's a buy and hold strategy. This clearly makes the most sense from a cost perspective. And that's what you document. You know, the issue comes down to what's available to the customer. But it's that type of documentation that I would expect to see in terms of, well, why'd you make this recommendation? Why'd you an A share versus a C? Or why did you, that way at least you have it.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Someone quickly asked with regard to physical signatures. A physical signature signs it, and you take a copy. The physical, I don't necessarily need the original. So hopefully I made that clear. Customer signs it, sends it to you, rep scans it and sends it to the supervisor. That's still a physical signature. And someone also referenced institutional share minimums. That's per broker, not client. I can go either way on that. And what I mean by that is I've read different prospectuses that if a customer qualifies as an institutional type of account, and generally those are at the $1 million level. I don't see the institutional share class as being the driving force. What I do see are some of the mutual fund families like Vanguard, the difference between the Admiral, which is 0.05%, and I think it's the investor share class, which is like 0.1 or 0.07, where the minimums are $3,000 and $5,000. I think that's the more of the challenge, I think, for the advisor and the customer. Because on those types of mutual funds that offer a lower share class with a lower barrier to entry. Any other comments, thoughts? I know a lot to digest, and I assure you we'll be able to get through this together as a group and even as an industry in terms of what other firms are seeing and how well they're I think, adjusting to the parameters and what needs to be done. Okay. I will double check on make that the information is up on the website for the advisors. I'll reconfirm with the IT department. And certainly if there are questions that you have specifically on any given situation, give me a call. I'll be happy to walk you through it. Same thing with the advisor. Okay. Listen, I appreciate everyone taking the time out today. And again, if there's something you need in the interim the next day, let me know. Anything else I can share with you, I will. But my phone is and emails are open. So if you have any questions, just let me know. But I certainly appreciate you taking the time out today on certainly short notice, but I certainly love the Soups, getting their reps together and putting us together. If I don't talk with you before the holiday, certainly have a great 4th of July and wish you all well. Take care. Be safe.